starts with you. Now here's Ash.
Not gonna lie, I'm a bit of a mess. And the reason I'm a bit of a mess is that I've been in two courtrooms all day, mostly virtually, but I was not gonna miss a second of Lori Vallow because I predicted that it would take less than an hour to find a verdict, a guilty verdict in her case. I was wrong, but it wasn't very long. It was under 3 hours and they found her guilty. The fascinating thing is that the jury that made the decision in under 3 hours to find that lady guilty of killing her husband did not know that she already had killed three other people. How do you like that? We kind of wondered. We wondered if they just remembered the news. We wondered if they'd heard about it. We wondered if just they'd put the pieces together during this murder trial that she'd already killed her children and she'd killed her boyfriend's wife and then married the guy. They didn't know. At least a few of them didn't. We're going to hear from some of those jurors tonight as to why they found her guilty anyway. Did the right thing. And then also the other courtroom I was ping-ponging back and forth was Karen Reid. It's on, y'all. Today was day one of the official evidentiary part of the Karen Reid retrial. That sounds boring till you see this. It was the A-team that was bolstered by a former juror taking part in this case. So there they are walking up. And then you can't see the people in pink, the sea of free Karen Reid people, because they were pushed a long way away from the courtroom. And by the way, the cops were out in full force making sure none of these people moved from the little bullpen that was set up for them, long way away from the courthouse. And it got ugly, and there was an arrest. I'm going to tell you all about that in a minute. And then I also want to tell you a star witness made an appearance today that did not show up in the first trial. And it is, I would dare say, the most important witness. And that person was heard in court today. I'll tell you about that in a hot minute. But also, a couple of witnesses right out of the gate did not make things good for Karen Reid. That's coming. And Scott Peterson is back. 854 pages worth of Scott Peterson. The LA Innocence Project has finally revealed the case that they have to fight for that guy to get his verdict thrown out. Maybe even to get him a new trial and get him out of prison. It's really interesting stuff, folks. Like a new couple of witnesses who say that they overheard conversations about Lacey Peterson having a confrontation with burglars. And by the way, a burglary that apparently happened 2 days earlier than the jury in his case originally heard. A confrontation with Lacey Peterson on the 24th? Really? Not a burglary on the 26th? That is all coming. Also, false evidence, they say, and new science that proves maybe the jury didn't hear the right case back in the day, 2 decades ago. I also have a little story about Tiger King, Joe Exotic. All of that is coming in a hot minute. Let's start here. Jury has spoken. Judgment has been rendered. And to the surprise of virtually no one, Lori Vallow stinks as a lawyer because she failed to get her client acquitted of charges that she conspired to murder her fourth husband 6 years ago. That Maricopa County jury in Arizona took less than 3 hours to find Lori Vallow, the client, guilty. 2 hours, 57 minutes, and 58 seconds to be exact. It's what you call a fast verdict. Here is the exact moment where Lori, acting as her own lawyer, found out what a fool for a client she had.
I'll ask the clerk to read and record the verdict.
In the Superior Court of the State of Arizona in and for the County of Maricopa, State of Arizona versus Lori Daybell, CR 2021-001704-001, verdict count one. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn in the above entitled action upon our oaths, do find the defendant, Lori Daybell, as to the crime of count one, conspiracy to commit first degree murder, occurring on or about July 11, 2019, guilty. Signed, poor person. Is this your true verdict? So say you won and all.
Yes.
On the court's own motion, I'll go ahead and ask the clerk to poll the jury.
Juror number one, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number two, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number six, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number seven, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number eight, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number nine, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 10, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 11, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 12, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 13, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 15, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Juror number 16, is this your true verdict?
Yes.
Yeah, you could tell she was getting bored of hearing that all those people don't like her, don't believe her. I think she's used to getting her way. And when she doesn't, she turns her head. What might be the most unbelievable part of this trial is that when those jurors were discharged and thanked by the judge for their service, they left the courthouse and some said they had no idea that that lady that they were sitting in judgment of, that she had already killed three people, including her own two kids, and had already been on trial for it and been found guilty of it. Yeah, that's a gut punch if you had any reservations at all. And it turns out some of them did. I'm joined now by somebody who was in the courtroom for all of it. Lindsay Haller is the producer of my podcast, Drop Dead Serious. She watched all of this unfold. So Lindsay, first of all, I am just gobsmacked by the fact that some of these jurors said they didn't know. But take me to the ones that you spoke to and the feedback that you got from them when they left the courthouse.
Yeah, so they did not know. They were actually found out as they were walking out of the courthouse. They were told, just Google it. There's a lot of stuff. And, you know, go look on Netflix. There's a lot of things. So the juror I spoke to, she said that, you know, she had no idea she killed her kids. I was actually with someone who said that she was from Rexburg, where the kids were murdered. And I think when, you know, you hear the kids were killed and then she said Rexburg, where they were murdered, she had a horrified look on her face and her eyes had tears in them. This was so overwhelming. But we heard from quite a few today, so take a look.
Knowing how high profile this case was.
It was very high.
What's going through your head?
Sadness. It's sad. Oops, I'm sorry. It's just sad that, you know, this has happened to Charles and she's given up her life as well. It's sad.
What did you think of her defending herself? Anything that went through the jury's head with that?
Well, for me personally, I thought, what does she have to lose? Guilty or not guilty, what does she have to lose?
So were any of you folks aware that this woman had already been convicted?
I have never heard of three homicides.
Yeah,
no,
and
I've
the
never
jurors
heard of
did not
before.
Know that.
No, I did not.
And nobody brought it.
Did you?
Ma'am, would you want to come in and talk to? What was your experience?
There's a lot of backstory here, and this woman had already been convicted of three homicides. And they obviously didn't want you folks to know that. Nobody knew that during your deliberations.
No.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Well,
what was this experience like for you?
It was sad, as he said. For me, it was the text messages that did it as far as evidence. And I feel like we uncovered some lies. So,
knowing now that she was convicted of killing her two children in Idaho.
I haven't had a chance to Google everything. I'm sure as soon as we get on the shuttle. So might have more to say later.
Was that difficult going through this and
yes,
not being able to
be
disconnected?
Yeah.
What
it just felt like there was a lot of information that didn't make sense and that was missing.
Do you think she did herself any favors by defending herself?
No.
You were not impressed with her lawyering skills?
No.
What did you think of her behavior during cross-examination, the way that at what moments she was argumentative with some of the witnesses?
I mean, many days she just was like smiling and laughing and didn't seem to take anything very seriously.
Was the fact that she didn't put up a defense or take the stand in her own defense part of your deliberation at all?
No. It was all evidence. It was all evidence that was produced and presented to us.
sorry if this was asked. What would you say the biggest piece of evidence for you guys as a jury was when you came to the decision?
Well, for me, like her, it was the text
history.
What specifically about the text?
Oh, there were so many.
There was two pages. Of them for me that really stood out.
Can you tell us which ones?
The Nephi.
That was one of them. Samuel B. Nephi and so will I. So that was one of them, but I don't know if I should say anything more.
We heard so much about dark spirits and religion and how this all plays into it. I mean, as a jury, what's going through your head when you start hearing that in court?
That didn't really play a big role because we have to have evidence of conspiracy, and that is not evidence of conspiracy to me.
Was it unusual for you guys to? I mean, you're talking about her brother Alex, the guy who actually did was the trigger man. So many players were referenced in this trial, and you never saw them, and never heard from them. That had to be confusing when
it
you guys got back
confusing.
In the jury room.
Yeah, it was very confusing.
It just felt
like there was so much of the story that was missing.
Did she have any valid arguments, like anything that made you think maybe she's not guilty?
Do you want to answer? I can't think of any.
You know, honestly, up until yesterday, I would have said not guilty. But when the prosecutor, I don't know, what do they call that? When they're closing argument. There's a few things she said in there, and then when I looked them up today, I was like, oh, yeah, that's bad.
You were still on the fence yesterday.
I was yesterday, yes.
Wow. Give us a sense of what it was like to be in that jury room. Was there a point that someone was disagreeing, saying that maybe she is not guilty?
Yes.
Were you guys
there was
all...
a couple.
And what was that like? Walk us through that.
It's just a matter of, you know, adults working things out and going through all the evidence and figuring out, you know, what we were going to come to an agreement with. So.
To learn now that everyone that was in that house that day, minus Daybell, is all not with us anymore, is dead or has been killed. I mean, what is that like to hear as jurors walking out?
Sad. Like, I kept wanting to hear from Tylee.
I was going to ask, is anybody wondering why Tylee wasn't testifying?
Yes.
He was.
Did you ever ask the judge why aren't they here?
No. And the one witness that really got to me was hearing Kay. I was holding back my emotions.
Oh, my Lord, there is so much there, just so incredibly much to what those jurors said. But first of all, way to go getting your microphone in that scrum of reporters and cameramen and streamers and everybody under the sun that wanted to hear from those jurors. I couldn't believe it, Lindsay, when the guy in the blue shirt, the juror, said, up until yesterday, I was on the fence, and that it was the prosecutor's closing that brought him back to the evidence and to a guilty verdict. It's just remarkable.
It is crazy. And what's even crazier is there was another juror that said that initially they were 10 to 2 when they first started deliberating. It didn't sound like the other two were like firm, not guilty. They just needed to go through the evidence and make sense of it again. But it was wild even just hearing that. But, you know, there was so much that they didn't know that it actually was pretty cool to see. You know, they still convicted her, and they truly did not know if she did get a fair trial.
And it was very interesting to hear the woman to the left of the man in the blue shirt. I'm assuming they didn't want to share their identities because you know, the whole world wants to hear from them. But that she said that she was very sad and kept wanting to hear from Tylee, which is a murdered child of Lori. Lori murdered Tylee, and Tylee was part of that whole self-defense baloney. So the fact that she wanted to hear from Tylee, I guess they were just all confused as to why two of the dead parties weren't in that courtroom testifying.
Right, and I can't imagine, like I said earlier, one of my friends mentioned that, you know, I'm from Rexburg, I'm where the kids were murdered. That's not even, well, Tylee was destroyed, annihilated. Her body was mutilated in a pet cemetery. So when these jurors find that out, I can't even imagine what they're going to be thinking, because this is not, they weren't just, you know, shot. If that makes it better, it doesn't, but
yeah. No, they were,
it's,
they were,
it's going to be a lot.
It was awful what happened to these. Yeah. I mean, JJ was wrapped up like a mummy and buried off, you know, about 100 yards or so from Tylee. Tylee, they tried to dismember her. They tried to burn her dismembered pieces. And in failing that, they threw her into the pet cemetery. I mean, it's just a despicable, despicable crime. And then there was Charles. Poor Charles, who said he loved his wife, that she'd just gone off the deep end with this religion. And little did he know that that wife and her brother were going to, you know, ambush him and murder him there in his own home. But this jury did it. It's incredible that they were 10-2 and didn't know about these awful murders that she committed, you know, that same year, but they still got it right. Okay, one other question. Lori, we only had the back of her head for a lot of it, but tell me about her reaction, because when I watched her looking over as they were pulling the jury, it looked to me like sourpuss Lori kicked in and she didn't want to hear anything more about it. What was the demeanor of her when the verdict came in?
It was exactly like what you just said. She seemed upset. She wasn't nearly as talkative or cutesy or flirtatious. That was gone. In fact, the state was going to move into an aggravation phase, you know, bring the jury back in. And was this a dangerous crime? Did it meet these aggravating factors? And Lori said, no need. I'm going to stipulate to that fact. So she, in a sense, didn't even want to hear any more people saying guilty, or that was just my impression.
She probably didn't want to hear any more witnesses, like family members, come in and, you know, say what they really felt about what she, what she'd done in her past, etc. Maybe she just thought, you know what, wrap this all up now. I heard her excuse was it's the same penalty anyway, so who cares, you know. I got to wrap it there. Hey, Lindsay, thanks for doing that, and thanks for running. I don't know how exhausted your arm is trying to get your microphone and camera through that big scrum, but I'm glad you did it. Thanks for that. Appreciate it.
I had help. Thank you, Ashley.
All right, Lindsay, having to sit through that 2 weeks of that trial as well. Okay, it's been a busy day in court. If you thought that Karen Reed's army of supporters had lost a little faith or any interest in her case, you don't know Karen. That circus was back in full force outside the courthouse today for the kickoff to her second murder trial. And a star witness made an appearance in that courtroom right off the bat, one who did not testify the first time round. We're going to have that and a surprise arrest that was made outside the courthouse. It's all next. But I too got a feeling of deja vu this morning, watching Karen Reed walking up to the Massachusetts courthouse wearing one of those awesome signature suits, flanked by her trusted lawyers from last year's murder trial. And if you followed that case, you heard a lot of testimony that she killed her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, a Boston cop. But you also heard a lot of evidence that maybe John was killed at a party by some fellow cops and that Karen Reed was being framed for it. Folks in Dedham, Massachusetts are really split on this case, and they are loud about how they feel, showing up at the courthouse with signs and even bullhorns. It got so bad last year that the judge pushed the protest zone even further away from the courthouse. But no matter, the Free Karen Reed Army, they were back today and so hell-bent on being heard that one of them was actually arrested today.
So you just got to move.
He's just explaining it to me.
But you're not talking, so you can move.
I mean, I just got here, man. I just got into town.
Keep it moving.
I'll keep it moving. Yeah, can you tell me what's going on? Move? Yeah.
So you got a buffer zone. Right? So that's it.
What was that?
QR code.
I don't.
That guy was a video streamer, but he was hauled off and arraigned on charges of trespassing and disturbing the peace.
We were afraid something like this was going to happen because there's so many people visiting from out of town, but it doesn't reflect the rest of us, one bad seed. I mean, I just like 10 bad seeds in the police, law enforcement, doesn't mean they're all bad. I mean, and we're not anti-police, we're just anti-bad police.
Inside the courtroom, a brand new special prosecutor is leading the case this time. And right out of the gate, he said witnesses and Karen Reed herself in TV interviews will tell the court that she admitted to hitting John with her car.
And he looked up at Miss Reed and he said, "What happened?" And you'll hear her words to Firefighter Nuttall. She said, "I hit him. I hit him. I hit him."
Aha, but Karen Reed has a hotshot lawyer, and he is back, baby. And Alan Jackson, he was ready.
The evidence in this case will establish above everything else 3 points. There was no collision with John O'Keefe. There was no collision. There was no collision.
The first few witnesses painted a picture of Karen knowing that John was dead even before they found his body. But Reed was ready for the cameras after court.
I feel great. Today went well. We prepped hard. And I'm just proud of my team. I can't be prouder, and I feel fortunate to have them. And we've got the truth, so we just forge ahead.
All right, joining me now is News Nation national correspondent Caitlin Becker. She's been on the case since the beginning, and she's been there all day. So first, set the scene outside of court, because that was really one of the big brands of this case last year. There were so many people who turned out for and against her.
And there were a lot of people here today, Ashley, but the vibe was so different. I mean, you have to picture the courthouse is right behind me in the shot here. So imagine it's in the middle of a star. The supporters and the protesters have been pushed out in every direction, and they're kind of where the points of a star would be. So they're not up at the front. So they're all kind of scattered around, and it led to some chaotic, really tense energy. You could feel it in the air. The police were taking it really seriously, pushing anybody who looked like they could have either been a supporter of Karen Reed's or you got a lot of that today, too. People driving, literally that. People drove by this morning. Someone stopped in traffic screaming out for Karen Reed in front of literally where I'm standing. Four police officers jumped on the vehicle. So basically just what you saw behind me there, jumped on the vehicle and escorted them out of the way. That is how seriously they're taking these buffer zones. So even people who are driving by can't do that. And then you had this arrest of someone who had breached the buffer zone. That person, Ash, is still in custody. They had asked for an attorney, and our producer was in there trying to get a hold of them earlier. They're in the courthouse, not behind me, but the one to my right for, as you said, disturbing the peace and trespassing.
Man, that is no joke. What about the people who support the cops? Because they showed up last year, too. I almost thought they were going to come to blows, these two parties. But are they somehow keeping them separated from the Free Karen Reed people? Or how's that dynamic playing out?
You know, they're all kind of intermingled, and you see the difference. You have your Free Karen Reed people who are all dressed in pink, and then the supporters of the cops are the ones who generally are coming around holding American flags. So you can sort of see the difference there. But because they're not congregated in one area this time around, that part does seem a little bit more peaceful. But it did seem like there was more tension between both sides and the officers versus both sides going at one another. I mean, the law enforcement around here was even tough with a lot of the members of the press threatening to ticket our cars if we didn't move, you know, pushing the photographers out of the way. The energy here was so intense this morning, and it was unlike what we've seen so far during jury selection and pretrial hearings.
You know, I say this all the time, like a broken record, that trials are often won or lost in openings and closings. And we just heard that the closings in the Lori Vallow case made a huge difference for at least one of the jurors, maybe two. But the openings today, I love the description that you have for the comparison between the prosecutor, the new guy, Hank Brennan, and the old, you know, hotshot defense attorney, Alan Jackson.
Hank Brennan has been brought in for this retrial. He's really solid. He is a good attorney.
But Alan Jackson is a good showman. He is a good performer. And you saw that in those two clips that you played going into this segment. You have this idea of a solid attorney who's delivering the statements fact by fact. It makes a lot of sense. And then you hear Alan Jackson, who just got up there and was polished and articulate and charismatic, and his pacing and his timing was so different. He argued a really good case. Now, whether or not he is going to be able to back that up in the testimony and the cross-examination and the evidence that's going to be presented is another story. But based on openings alone, it was definitely a win for the Karen Reed sign. And you saw that in that clip of her coming out. When she walked into court, she had her somber look, face down, did not talk to the press like she usually does, really, really kind of kept a stiff upper lip. And then on the way out, it was smiles, it was chats. I mean, I think she would have continued to talk to us if her attorneys didn't push her out of the way.
They've got their work cut out for them. So today, real quickly, two witnesses that I watched, the firefighter who said, oh yeah, she said, I hit him. Well, a year ago, he said, I hit him only twice, you know, so that's a discrepancy. But then the friend of John O'Keefe, I thought her testimony was blistering against Karen Reed, saying, Karen called me at 5 a.m. saying, John's dead. I think he was hit by a snowplow. And that was long before anybody found John on the lawn. So that's going to be troublesome. But maybe, and this is what I was leading to up until now, maybe the most troublesome was Karen Reed made an appearance in that court by way of docuseries video clip. And it's the one I thought they'd play. The one where she said, I don't know, I was drunk. Maybe I hit him. I don't know if I thought I hit him. How powerful was that?
It really was a powerful moment, because in the beginning of Hank Brennan's opening statement, he said, you're going to hear that this witness said, she said, I hit him. But then he ends it with Karen Reed herself repeating that. So you sit there and your jaw kind of drops, because it's taken, and you're certainly out of the context of the interview, but it sounds like she admits to some frame of guilt there. But her team was ready. Her team was ready. Alan Jackson got up. He attacked that head on. He didn't hide from it. He didn't shake his head at it. He said, that wasn't what you saw. It wasn't a confession. What you saw there was a woman trying to make sense of a situation, looking at something, trying to understand, okay, what happened? Did I hit him? Could I have hit him? You know, what could have happened there? And he delivered it so masterfully that I think they knew that that was going to happen. And that's why they brought these two witnesses out first, because these were not the same two witnesses that were the first and second ones in the first trial. So I definitely think that was by design. And Ash, I will tell you, you're right. There was a big discrepancy with that first firefighter, and Alan Jackson went at him, really kind of hammered him on the stand. And at first you're like, oh yeah, absolutely. Then he kind of got aggressive. And it's almost as if the prosecutors ensured that the defense came out looking aggressive and kind of like a bulldog there, and that could perhaps turn off the jury.
Well, whenever you have the defendant herself and her words being played in court, and likely she won't take the stand, it's pretty powerful stuff. And Alan Jackson, you're right. He is always ready for it. Caitlin, thank you for this. I'm going to come back to you tomorrow to find out what else is on tap. Thanks for this.
Thanks,
Ash. Okie dokie, folks. Coming up, we knew Scott Peterson had a powerful ally in the LA Innocence Project, but we did not know how powerful until this week. The group has just unloaded the results of its 17-month investigation into the murders of Lacey Peterson and her unborn son. And their court filing is as long as a Grisham novel. Parts of it read like one, too. But is it enough to get Scott's conviction overturned? I will ask his former attorney when we come back. Or is cleared outright of killing his wife, Lacey, and their unborn son. The LA Innocence Project has made up its mind, and they have laid out a hell of a case that sure makes it look like he didn't do it. For the last year and a half, they have been preparing 854 pages filled with reasons that Scott's guilty verdict should be thrown out. Their case is bursting with new purported evidence that allegedly, and I quote, undermines the prosecution's entire circumstantial case against petitioner and shows that the jury relied on false evidence, including false scientific evidence, to convict him. Can I just say that if the people from the Innocence Project ever decide to take up your case, Let them. I will not sit here and pretend to have read all 854 pages. I did the Cliff Notes. But I can tell you that much of it centers on a burglary in Scott and Lacey's neighborhood right around the time that she disappeared. What's new is that the filing says it happened on December 24th, Christmas Eve, the day that Lacey vanished. And not on the 26th, as the prosecutors told the jury. The filing also says more people were involved in the burglary than the two men who copped to it. And it claims to have uncovered a witness who heard the burglars talking about a confrontation they had with Lacey after Scott had already left for the day. And that could not have happened if the prosecution's timeline and theory of the case is correct. The Innocence Group says it has evidence that links those burglars directly to a burned-out orange van that we've talked about before on this show, inside of which was a bloody mattress. And the group says that it can prove Lacey's body wasn't dumped where prosecutors said it was dumped, the very spot where Scott had been fishing in the San Francisco Bay. There's still a ton to unpack, so I'm thrilled to be joined by a man who knows this case better than anyone. Scott Peterson's former attorney, Mark Garagos, also friend of the show, and guy who knows a lot about the law, generally speaking. So, inside baseball and outside baseball, how big a deal is this? How new is this stuff?
Well, there's quite a few things that jumped out at me. I always remember when we started that trial. You may remember over 20 years ago, the prosecution's theory was is that Lacey was killed on the 23rd. By the time we got to the end of the trial, almost a year later, they had conceded that she was alive on the 24th, which was the only thing you could do. The evidence showed that clearly she was alive that morning. And we figured that out just by the cross-examination of the forensic expert. But the thing that's particularly galling for me, having tried this case, was the fact that that orange van was found in such close proximity and that it had been set on fire. And they knew, the prosecution knew, I put it on the record repeatedly, and even more so, my then partner and co-counsel, Pat Harris, was fixated on the burglary across the street. I mean, that was his theory, his working theory the entire time. They knew that's what we were looking at, and this petition details how the prosecution worked to avoid giving the defense any of this stuff in real time. That is what galls me about this.
I'm also really interested to hear about these new sworn witnesses that say that they, you know, overheard conversations, confrontations that Lacey had with these burglars at a time that they're saying the burglary did not happen. Are these new people? Have they ever, appeared before? Were they part of the original adjudication of Scott's case? Like, who are they and why is this such a big deal right now?
But remember what happened. The jury had deliberated for about 9 days, and the judge kept removing jurors who were holdouts. And finally, on day 9, they came back with the guilty verdict. And on that day, the prosecution handed me a report, which they had never disclosed in the previous year, which said a lieutenant at one of the prisons had overheard a prisoner talking to his relative about confronting Lacey across the street. And I said, how could you sit on this and wait until the day the verdict comes in after the jury's been deliberating for 9 days and then hand me that? There's a picture right there on your screen of Pat Harris. And I was appalled by that. I'm appalled by a lot of what's in here. As I have said, and I thank you for noting it, I don't think there's anybody who knew the evidence better in real time than I did when I tried this case. And I saw nothing other than that he didn't act right evidence, meaning the tapes with Amber, that gave any credence to the idea that this person who had absolutely no violence in his background, who was basically adored his wife, would ever have done harm to her, let alone his unborn child. It was just inconceivable.
Well, He did write over 100 pages as part of this submission, and I think a lot of people watching right now who were very invested in this case would say, adore Schmoor. He was sleeping with Amber Fry, cheating on her, and even at Lacey's memorial was yammering on the phone. Total schmuck, absolute schmuck. And he addresses the schmuckiness of himself in these pages, doesn't he?
Well, we were very upfront about that. He knew. He had lived through Gary Condit in that same area in Modesto. Gary Condit was a then congressman. As soon as somebody from the media found out that Gary Condit was having an affair with a woman who went missing, Chandra Levy, game over. The prosecution, the law enforcement didn't do any further investigation. As it turned out, they missed the most obvious suspect and they bungled everything. So he knew that if he admitted to Amber, or if Amber got to the police, that they would stop searching for Lacey, which is why he went through such great lengths to tell her the lies that he told her. But the fact remains, there was no forensic evidence. There was no motive. There was no evidence whatsoever of when she died, how she died, where she died. It was the ultimate. And one of the reasons why it still captivates us, and you and I are still talking about it 21 years later.
Yeah, and there's new science coming in this as well, which I'm looking forward to. By the way, I just love looking at the pictures of you, you know, 21 years ago. You haven't aged a bit. Thanks, Garrett Ghost. Appreciate this.
Thank you.
I knew you were going to say something, but we'll talk again. Okay, folks, answer me this. How many killers have we talked about on this show who did themselves in with their Google searches and their browsing history and their online purchases? If I had a dime for every defendant who says, oh, if only I hadn't found the searches. Well, now a doctor in Minnesota can breathe easy because his searches, the ones that police say prove he poisoned his wife, they're being tossed in the trash. And believe it or not, he has the very cops investigating him to thank for it. I'll fill in the blanks on this one in a hot minute. Died of food poisoning in August of 2023. Something didn't sit right. She was 32 years old and strong as an ox. So investigators got suspicious. And their side eyes soon landed directly on her husband, Connor Bowman. Yes, that Connor Bowman, Dr. Connor Bowman, from the Mayo Clinic, no less, in Minnesota. Before that, Dr. Bowman was a pharmacist, and you guessed it, a poison control expert. Betty Jo's friends told the police that she'd wanted a divorce and that Dr. Bowman was drowning in debt. And what's more, he collected $500,000 in life insurance when Betty Jo died. He was also in a big hurry to cremate her. But lucky for the cops, he did not get his wish. And when the medical examiner tested her for everything under the sun, they found that Betty Jo Bowman was poisoned by colchicine, a medicine used to treat gout. And Betty Jo didn't have gout. Never did. Police then got a number of search warrants and started digging through 15 electronic devices from the couple's home. And wouldn't you know it, they discovered that her husband, Connor, had calculated the lethal dose of colchicine and even looked for where to buy it 5 days before Betty got sick. He also searched for, and I quote, internet browsing history. Can it be used in court? And delete Amazon data police. Circumstantial, I get it, to be sure. But it's super strong evidence just the same. And for prosecutors in a first-degree murder case, it is almost a smoking gun. But in a blow to the police and the prosecutors, that evidence is going in the trash. Last week, a judge decided that the warrants went too far and were nowhere near as specific as the law required them to be. So anything that was learned from 14 of the 15 devices that were seized, off limits for the trial. And that includes texts, emails, photos, and yes, internet searches about toxins. It also includes any communications about money, divorce, and relationship problems. So what do the prosecutors have left? Well, I guess we're going to find out in court, but they are not talking right now until they have to. And a trial date has not yet been set. But watch this space. I'm on Betty Jo's side here. Coming up, he still has a ways to go to catch up with Lori Vallow. But a prison inmate that we all know well is closing the gap when it comes to collecting legal husbands. Joe Exotic, the one-time Tiger King, just said, I do again. And when we come back, you will meet the new Mr. Exotic, spouse number 6 by Joe's count. But wait until you hear what sent him to prison and how this marriage could upend Joe's bid to be freed. Officially off the market for the 6th time. The gun-toting, mullet-rocking Oklahoma zookeeper who shot to fame as Joe Exotic, the Tiger King, has just announced that he is married again. I know, it's hard to keep track of all 6 husbands, because not all of them were formal. A decade ago, he actually married 2 men at once, unofficially, in a ceremony that you can still find on YouTube. But this time, Joe Exotic has tied the knot in Texas, in the prison where he is serving 20-plus years for hiring a hitman to kill Carol Baskin. Carol Baskin was his rival, and luckily, she is still alive and well, as is Joe, who's now 62. And while missing his guns and his zoo, he still has his mullet. As for the new hubby, this is a 33-year-old fella. He's locked up right alongside Joe, but his crime is human trafficking, i.e., slipping himself and a half dozen other undocumented immigrants into the United States from Mexico, which could be a fatal blow to Joe's other driving passion, and that is getting a pardon from President Trump. You know, Trump not being so big on the whole illegal immigration stuff. So the only thing I can say to that is that this marriage must be love, because human trafficking? That's it for tonight, everybody. Thanks so much for watching. Check out my podcast.